Thank you very much. Can y'all hear me okay?
Yes.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here in Texas. I'm from South Carolina, and I don't know as much about Texas as I ought to know. I've been out here a few times, and it's always a great pleasure. Feels like I'm in a different country. I think South Carolina and Texas are the only two states that I've seen where you see the state flag and symbol everywhere. We have it in South Carolina on every cap, every shirt, and Texas is the same way. So in that respect, we have a lot in common. I've been allowed to say something about the Abbeville Institute, which I'd like to say a little bit about before the talk, because I think it's something that we all should know about and I think should support if we're interested in the Southern tradition. I am a professor. I was just retired from Emory. I'm a recovering academic. It's kind of like alcoholism. You have to go to RA meetings every once in a while. But we were concerned that the Southern tradition is not really taught anymore in higher education, even in Southern institutions. Things about the South are taught, but they are taught as a function of political correctness. The Southern tradition, from its own point of view, is just not there. So we decided to see how many academics in America are interested in this tradition and share our views. It turns out there are quite a few. We have over 150 academics associated with the Institute. And what we do mainly is we have an annual summer school for college and graduate students. We're trying to educate the next generation of professors. If we can find people interested. And if they're not going into academics, we want to find those pearls of great price that will become ministers, lawyers, and involved in civic affairs. Because the only way you're going to change your culture is at the elite level. The people rarely ever change cultures. It's the elites that run the show. The ministers, the lawyers, the people in the professions, and the people of wealth. So that's our goal, we were formed at the University of Virginia 12 years ago. We had just about 12 people. Now we have quite a few. 15 of our students now have their doctorates and are teaching. We have a brilliant student at Cambridge University in England, and the British are paying him to come over and get a PhD. So we have some outstanding students that we think will be placed in positions of influence. At least that's our hope. So I would like for you to consider supporting the Institute in two ways. One, financially, of course, but also in recommending students for our summer school. We need to find good students, people who are interested in the Southern tradition, will know more about it, and who have academic or civic promise. I have some newsletters here. There were more than that. What happened to the others?
He's passed them out.
Oh, he's passed them out, yeah. Let me say, those of you who already know about the Institute, don't take a newsletter because I don't have enough for everybody. But those who, I'd like for those who don't know about it to get the newsletter and look at it. And we have some more up here. Okay, thank you very much. Our topic in this conference is the legacy of the war and what we lost in Mr. Lincoln's very clumsy and brutal invasion. Let me begin by saying that we Americans have inherited two conflicting visions of what America is and ought to be. All of us have inherited these two visions, and they were there from the beginning. The war was fought over those two visions, and they still exist today. And they're no more reconciled today than they were at the beginning or in the middle. I'm going to give names to these. I've taken Jefferson as a symbol of one of these visions, and Lincoln as a symbol of the other. And I'm thinking of them abstractly. I'm boiling Jefferson down to his core and Lincoln down to his core. And the reason I've chosen those two figures is because they articulate better than anybody else the core of those two visions. So there were Jeffersonians before Jefferson, the anti-federalists, we can read as sort of Jeffersonian types. Hamilton is Lincoln before Lincoln, and this goes on today. Now, Jeffersonian America dominated from 1776 to 1860. In other words, this style of thinking was America. But after 1865, the Lincolnian vision begins to be established, so that America today is dominated by this Lincolnian vision. But around 1960, this Lincolnian vision began to fracture. And it has since fractured into a number of ideologies, which I don't have time to go into. I'm writing a book trying to understand that. But the point is, it's fractured, and it is in war with itself, at war with itself. Now, one indication of this is a book by a professor of political science at Harvard, Samuel Huntington, who wrote a famous book, Clash of Civilizations. He wrote another book shortly before he died, a few years ago, called Who Are We? Who Are We? Challenges to America's National Identity. And he argues that the central government for the last 40 or 50 years has followed policies which are tearing apart American national identity. The national identity that came with after Lincoln, this is when we become a nation, not a federation, but a nation, that national identity is collapsing. It didn't exist prior to Lincoln. There was no nation like that. It's collapsing. And he says, unless there is a long protracted war, or unless the central government takes real strong measures, it will disintegrate. So he writes this book to try to get the government going to do something about it. Because after the war between the states, this nationalist identity of America was disintegrating. So the Pledge of Allegiance was created, national groups of all sorts were created to try to prop up this flagging nationalism, which was rather artificial. We forget that the Pledge of Allegiance wasn't approved by Congress in 1942, and the Star-Spangled Banner wasn't approved in 1937, I think. So this nationalism was a long time coming, because it was not natural to America. There were lots of songs about America, but no national anthem until much later. Okay, what I want to do now is try to describe these two visions of America, and I have to boil things down for matters of time. And let's begin with their views of the Constitution. There are a lot of things we could say, but that would be the best place to begin. Now, for the Jeffersonians, the Constitution is a compact, as you know, between distinct sovereign political societies, creating a central government as an artificial corporation to which were delegated a few enumerated powers. All other powers are reserved to the states. Now, since those reserved powers are not enumerated and are undefined, Madison and Jefferson said it's up to the states themselves to say what they are and what the remedies are for protecting them from intrusion by the central government. Madison said a state could, quote, interpose to protect its citizens from federal tyranny. Jefferson said a state could lawfully nullify an intrusion into its reserved powers. And it could do this only because it was a sovereign state. Now, Jeffersonian Americanism dominated from the Declaration of Independence until 1860, when South Carolina did in fact secede. During this period, state nullification and secession were considered options in every section of the Union. There was no time, really, in which this was not considered an option. The Lincolnian vision, however, flatly contradicts the Jeffersonian vision at its foundation, for it denies that the states are sovereign political societies. Rather, it is the American people in the aggregate that are sovereign. And the Constitution is not a compact between sovereign states, but a national constitution where the central government is supreme and where the states function in a way similar to counties. Indeed, Lincoln explicitly compared the states to counties. In a speech, February 12, 1861, Lincoln asked rhetorically, quote, "What is this peculiar sacredness of a state? If a state in one instance and a county in another should be equal in extent of territory and equal in the number of people, wherein is that state any better than the county? Can a change of name change the right?" End quote. Now, Southerners, of course, concluded that a man who couldn't tell the difference between a county and an American state probably wasn't fit to be president. Now, if the states are not sovereign political societies, just imagine that, then Lincoln is right. They cannot lawfully nullify acts of the central government, it's unconstitutional, nor can they secede from the Union any more than a county can lawfully nullify acts of the legislature or secede. Okay, so you see the big difference. They're incommensurable. And if you're a Lincolnian, you have to deny the Jeffersonian vision, and vice versa. Now, I want to present a picture of the basic outlines of Jeffersonian America as it existed from around 1776 to 1860. And what I'm going to describe is not an idea of America, it's the actual practice, the fact. This is what it was actually like. Jefferson's election was known as, quote, the Revolution of 1800. Well, why was it a revolution? Because it was in opposition to the centralizing tendencies urged by Hamilton and implemented in the Washington and Adams administration. Jefferson's revolution was founded on state sovereignty. That was the revolution. And the claim that the 10th Amendment is the foundation of the Constitution. So this is sort of the revenge of the Anti-Federalists. An important plank in this platform was fiscal reform. The Anti-Federalists did not want the central government to have any original taxing power. That was to be reserved to the states. They failed to build that prohibition into the Constitution, and the central government, when it started its career, was immediately faced with what? A tax revolt, the Whiskey Rebellion. And Jefferson ran on a platform that if he were elected, he would abolish all inland federal taxes. Whew. And he succeeded. The federal government would, after Jefferson, live mainly off a tariff on imports and to a lesser extent from land sales. From Jefferson's election until the secession of South Carolina, Americans paid no direct taxes to the federal government. except for a brief period in which taxes were raised to pay for the War of 1812. So the government could tax inland. There's no constitutional prohibition, but politically it was prevented from doing so by the states. Jefferson also inveighed against public credit, the practice of borrowing money backed by the taxes of future generations. He also sought to get the central government out of debt. In this, he did not succeed. But Andrew Jackson, another Jeffersonian, did. Jackson destroyed the Bank of the United States in 1835, which was the equivalent of destroying the Federal Reserve today. Quite a feat he performed. For the first time, the central government was out of debt and stayed close to that goal up to 1861, except for an easily managed debt to cover the Mexican War. And that was $65 million. That's what the war cost. And that was less than the total expenditures of the federal government in 1858. So that was a manageable debt, less than the expenditures of 1 year. There had never been anything in the world like Jeffersonian America. It was a unique thing. The people of Europe were burdened with taxes and loaded with debt. They were ruled by centralized monarchies with large standing armies. Americans did not fear a large standing national army because there wasn't one. The sword was in the hands of state militias. Americans were nearly free of federal taxes and federal debt. The states could tax them, but they didn't tax much either. The central government's expenditure on the eve of Lincoln's invasion of the South was less than 2% of GNP. Today it's around 35%. That's just the feds. This spectacular shift of power from the central government began with what we might call the Lincolnian Revolution of 1865, which overthrew the Jeffersonian Revolution of 1800. In wealth, America equaled that of Europe, and it was more evenly distributed. Since it was still a frontier country on the move, its cultural achievements were not equal, but its literacy rate was higher, and it was beginning to make a mark in the arts and sciences. Those who aspired to republican government in Europe saw America as a model to emulate. Switzerland, for example, changed its constitution in 1848 from a loose confederation to a federal system of states in emulation of Jeffersonian America. Like the Anti-Federalists and the Jeffersonians, the Swiss were worried about giving the central government original taxing power. Don't do it, because that's where the tyranny comes from. So their constitution prohibited it. They did what the Anti-Federalists wanted to do. And they still have it. In Switzerland, even today, the central government may tax only for a certain period of time and at a certain rate. After that period has lapsed, it has no taxing power whatsoever, and it can regain power only by a constitutional amendment. And that requires a majority of the cantons and a majority of the individuals. I think from 1950 on, they've done that 9 times. A further limit on the central government in Switzerland is that only 50,000 signatures are needed to force any federal law up to a referendum. That's nullification. And only 100,000 signatures can force a referendum to amend the Constitution. A Swiss friend of mine, who is the secretary of the academy there, said that one day they woke up and the left had gotten enough signatures to vote on an amendment to abolish the army. Well, you could do it. And they have to go scramble and vote, say no. But, you know, they have to do that. Switzerland, the Switzerland of 1848 was a Jeffersonian outpost in Europe. See the point? It was the only republic in Europe. It was modeled on America, on Jeffersonian America. It still is a Jeffersonian outpost in Europe. We are not a Jeffersonian country anymore, but they are. Another federation influenced by Jeffersonian America is Canada. The Canadian provinces have the constitutional right of state nullification and secession. Any Canadian province may nullify any federal law in the area of civil rights within its borders. It can opt out. And for example, if gay marriage was instituted, Manitoba could opt out, and gay marriage would hold everywhere but Manitoba. And every Canadian province has a right to a public referendum on secession whenever it wishes. Both of these are denied to Americans in the Lincolnian vision. Now, how Canada got these rights is an interesting story. Judah Benjamin, who was Secretary of State in the Confederacy, fled to England after the war and became a distinguished barrister. He took up and won a number of cases for the Canadian provinces, and as a result, planted states' rights principles in Canadian common law. When the Canadians got their constitution in 1982, all of that common law was in there, they inherited that, and they used that to put in the principle of nullification. A friend of mine, a senator from Canada, John Stewart, said that to me one time that there's a saying in Canada that the South, having lost the war in America, won it in Canada. where they talk about nullification and secession as policy options, sometimes in spirited ways, but it can be talked about. The Jeffersonian Americanism that lasted from 1776 to 1860 received support throughout the Union. So it's not just a Southern thing, but it was Southern leadership that established it and that maintained it. To give you an example, from the Constitution ratification to 1860, there were 11 presidents from the South, only five from the North. Attorney generals, 14 from the South, only five from the North. Supreme Court justices, 17 from the South, 11 from the North. Speakers of the House, 21 and 12 from the North. Further, the South was remarkable for its entrepreneurship. As of 1860, it had the fourth largest economy in the world. Nobel economist laureate Robert Fogel co-authored with Stanley Ingram on a study of the economics of the Old South. Time on the Cross is the title. You probably know about it, most of you. They argued that white Southern agriculture was more productive than Northern, and that plantation agriculture was more productive than either. Well, this productivity of plantation agriculture was not possible without training and giving considerable responsibility to the black labor force. Most overseers were black slaves, and slaves were encouraged to increase production through pecuniary incentives and promotion to positions of status. A few planters even left management of the entire plantation to slaves who purchased supplies, planted, harvested, and sold the crops with the owner receiving a certain amount of the profits. There weren't too many of those, but that did happen. Ben Montgomery, a slave, managed the plantation of Jefferson Davis's brother. He was taught many skills and invented an ingenious propeller for steamships, but was denied a patent from the federal government because he was a slave. He was again denied the patent after the war, even after he was not a slave. By contrast, the Confederacy allowed slaves to own patents and make money off them. Jefferson Davis got that change in place. The South had more miles of railroad than any country in the world except the North, and the South had the highest per capita income in the nation. That's true of every Southern state. And this is true even when the income of blacks is factored in. Slaves consume around 90% of what they produce, according to Fogel. Now, this flourishing economy and society was destroyed by Lincoln's invasion and his decision to turn the war on civilians. The Lincoln administration did not launch an invasion to free slaves. Both Lincoln and Congress went out of their way to insist that emancipation was not a war aim. The reason for invasion was simply that the Northern industrial ruling class was determined to dominate the continent economically and politically. The war, as you know, the figures now are somewhere between 750,000 battle deaths, but if you include the civilians, especially the number of slaves that died after emancipation, there's a book you may have seen called Sick from Freedom by Jim Downs, and it documents the tens of thousands of blacks that died in the contraband camps that were hastily thrown up to take care of these huge numbers of blacks that were moving toward Union armies, cut off from their subsistence. And Lincoln had made no provision for this. It was just awful. And the people that died of malnutrition, the infants that died early because of diseases due to malnutrition and so on, you're probably talking about close to a million people when you count all of that in. There's a study in Britain, I can't remember, I wish I could find it, but I read it one time. It studied the number of women who died within a year after learning that their husbands, loved ones, and so on had been killed in World War I. The mortality rate was out of proportion to what it would have been ordinarily. So somehow the war brought about probably a reduction in their immune system or something through depression. So these wars are just horrible, and Americans have yet to confront really what happened. Now, to understand why the South seceded, you need only to read the Confederate Constitution. They wanted that kind of government. It's mute testimony to what their reasons were. You don't even have to read the letters of the soldiers or any of that stuff. Just read the Confederate Constitution. It tells the truth. Southerners could see a ruling class emerging in the North that was tone deaf to the restraints imposed by the Constitution their fathers had ratified. By seceding, they did not intend to come up with a new Constitution. They simply reformed the original Constitution to bring it into closer accord with Jeffersonian America. So we're not going to get any new Constitution. Confederate Constitution is not some bright idea. It's not a new Constitution. It's simply the U.S. Constitution reformed in certain respects. In what respects? Southerners learned from their bad experience in the Union that the best way to control the central government from tyranny was to restrain the ability to spend money, to gather and spend money. You cut the revenue flow off, control the faucet, like the Swiss did. They learned that from the Anti-Federalists. Unlike the Anti-Federalists, the Swiss, the Confederates did not deny taxing power to the central government, but they severely limited its ability to build up a corrupt system of patronage. First, it required the high bar of 2/3 vote of both houses for a spending bill. Second, the bill had to be for one item in its title. This eliminated tacking on programs for special interests that had nothing to do with the purpose of the bill. Try to get that through today. But they got it through. I mean, they actually did it. Third, bills to fund federal internal improvements, such as railroads, canals, were prohibited. These projects were to be funded by private enterprise and the states. Fourth, so you couldn't build an interstate highway across the United States unless you got permission of each state to go through. We wouldn't have so many fast food places if we'd had that. Fourth, bills to subsidize business corporations were prohibited. Fifth, the federal government could spend money to improve the means of commerce, such as building lighthouses and cleaning out harbors, but the government was being reimbursed by a fee paid by the users, not by some other section of the union. Seventh, the president was given a line item veto and a single 6-year term. The Confederate Constitution also gave the states increased power to check federal tyranny. First, any state, by a 2/3 vote of both houses, could impeach any federal officer operating within its borders to be tried in the Confederate Senate. This sent a message, behave yourself. Somebody's watching. The people are watching. The legislature of Alabama is watching. This would be a permanent warning, and so on. Second, and this is one of the most important reforms, any 3 states could initiate a constitutional amendment. And it took only 2/3 of the states to ratify. If we had that measure, you know, Supreme Court outlawed school prayer, abortion, gay marriage, all this other stuff that's going on, the courts do, it wouldn't happen. The people the state legislatures could. Do you think in 1950 the state legislatures, if say a comparable proportion, could initiate amendment, they would have killed that school prayer business in America in the 50s. It would been the end of it. But the states don't do it. Third, new states could enter the Confederacy, but it required 2/3 majority of both houses. Under the U.S. Constitution, a mere majority of Congress permits a new state to enter. Now, that is very bad. That's a very destabilizing constitutional rule, because when new states come in, they suddenly create new majorities and new minorities. Big interests are affected, so you just don't let states come in like that. You need to think about it. Now, consider the annexation of Texas. Being a foreign country, annexation required a treaty to be confirmed by 2/3 vote of the Senate. If we want to bring Denmark into the United States, it's going to take 2/3 of the Senate, 2/3 of the states. Well, they didn't get the votes anywhere near. Northern states are not about to let Texas in. To get around this, Congress, here the Southerners are the problem. Congress, by a questionable maneuver, decided that a joint resolution by a simple majority of both houses would be sufficient. We'll just bring them in that way. The measure passed by just two votes in the Senate. Northern leaders were understandably furious and saw this as an illegitimate grab of power by the Southern states. John Quincy Adams immediately and other Northern leaders urged secession from the Union, as their fathers had done a generation earlier over the Louisiana Purchase in the War of 1812. Back then, some of the New Englanders said that Virginia wants to become, quote, the Austria of America, build a big agricultural empire at the expense of New England. Well, you could see their point. This was not good. So had they stuck to the Constitution and requiring two-thirds vote of the Senate, Texas probably would never have entered the Union. Would never have entered the Union because the interest in the North for a long time would have probably prevented that because the vote was so overwhelmingly against it in the Senate. So these constitutional rules are very important. And the Southerners saw that, and they corrected that mistake. I turn now to Lincolnian Americanism. Having excluded secession and nullification, the only remedy the Lincolnian has for protecting the reserve powers of the states are national elections. That's the only remedy. The only remedy. Well, that might be okay if there is adequate representation in the national government. But there isn't. Nowhere near it. What is adequate representation? Well, Madison said there should be one representative in the House for every 30,000 people. Some people thought it could be 40,000, but let's just stick with Madison's. One representative for every 30,000 people. Now, as population increased, what would happen? Members of the House would grow. But in 1910, the Progressive Congress capped representation in the House at 435, where it remains today. But the population today is 319 million, yielding a ratio of one representative for every 735,000 people. Now, this is not representative government. By mid-century, there might well be 435 million Americans, yielding one representative for every million persons. So in junior and civics class, you're told, write your congressman. You have an obligation to get involved in your own government. Express your views. Let your congressman know. Yeah, right. In short, now notice, I'm talking now about, not about ideas, I'm talking about a physical structural fact. As population increases, the quality of representation in America diminishes. It's already diminished to a meaningless extent. What are we to do? It will not do to increase the size of the House. A lawmaking body should not grow much beyond 435 representatives. If you look around the world, Britain has the largest ones, about 630. But most of them are around 200, 300, 400 representatives. It's about right. It shouldn't be any bigger. But if we did increase it, and we used Madison's ratio, there would be 10,500 members in the House today. representatives in the House if we had adequate representation. But what are we to conclude from this, that Madison's ratio is wrong, or that the United States has grown so large that representative government at the national level is simply no longer possible? It's not that it's difficult, it's impossible. And that it will diminish further with every increase of population. This problem is not going to go away. And neither party's talking about it. You haven't heard anything about it. Now, to fully appreciate this, Imagine that the first Congress in 1789, when the population was around 4 million, used our ratio. If you say, well, you know, we're bigger, you know, but our ratio is okay. Okay, well, let's just apply it back then. In that case, there would be only 5 members in the House. Since there were 13 states, 5 states would have 1 representative. Now, is that representative government? No. But 8 states would have none. And that is the quality of representation we have today. That's the quality of representation we have today. Or consider representation in the 5 great countries of Europe: Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. Their population is about the same as the United States, 319 in total. Each has an upper house of representation, a lower house, and each has a better ratio of representation to population than the United States. Britain, for instance, with a population of 64 million, has a ratio of 1 for every 44,000, not far from Madison's ratio of 1 for every 30,000. And some Americans thought 1 for 40,000 would be good. But in the United States, the ratio is 1 for every 735,000. Or to put it another way, if we take the combined population of the 5 countries of Europe, it's the same as the United States, 319 million, and we combine their representatives, we end up with a total of 7,571, whereas the combined total for the United States, including the Senate, is 535. The United States has the least representative government of any democracy in the world, and probably any government in the world. Maybe not China, but any. The United States is the worst. Let me say that again. The United States has the least representative government at the national level than any democracy in the world. The worst. See, we talk about American exceptionalism, American liberty, and it's the greatest country in the world, and so on. That's all very well, but we need to actually look at some facts before we make those judgments. They might be true, but they have to be mitigated. Yet, bad as it is, this loss of representation in Congress is not the worst of it. We haven't even begun to look at the corruption. For most of the laws we live under are not passed by Congress at all, but spring from the vast and impenetrable bureaucracy of the executive branch. Last year, when I looked at Obamacare, it was 20,000 pages and growing, because it's written by the bureaucracies. That's where the laws are written, and Congress has very little say over it. We have very little say over Congress. Nor is that all. Fundamental social policy, such as the place of religion in society. What is more important than that? Gay marriage, morals, welfare, education, law enforcement, and many other issues closest to the people are not decided in state legislatures where the Constitution places them, but by 9 politically well-connected, unelected lawyers on the Supreme Court. The people of the several states have altered their constitutions to prohibit gay marriage, welfare to illegal immigrants, and other matters, only to see them struck down by a federal judge or by the Supreme Court. But there is more. The Jeffersonians, from the Anti-Federalists to the Confederacy, sought to prevent federal tyranny by restricting the ability of Congress to tax, spend, and borrow money. Remember that? This check was accomplished by a vigorous use of state sovereignty. In the Lincolnian vision, however, the only check is national elections, which have proved progressively futile as representation has dwindled to zero. Now consider this. A lawmaking majority of the House and Senate plus the President is only 269 people for 319 million. And if a quorum is used, it can be as low as 135. This small number rules 319 million people and last year spent nearly $4 trillion, an amount greater than the gross national product of Germany. Never in human history has so much financial and political power been put in the hands of so few, certainly financial power. The federal debt has reached $18 trillion, an amount about equal to the country's GNP. Recall that when the Jeffersonians governed America under Southern leadership, most Americans paid no direct federal taxes at all, and from 1835 to 1860 were under hardly any federal debt. The federal government consumed in 1860 less than 2% of GNP, and today it's around 35%. Jefferson wrote Gideon Granger in 1800, the year of his election to the presidency. This is when the revolution begins, of 1800. Quote, "Our country is too large to have all its affairs directed by a single government. Public servants at such a distance will invite the public agents to corruption, plunder, and waste. And I do verily believe that if the principle were to prevail of a common law being in force in the United States, which reduces us to a single consolidated government, it would become the most corrupt government on the earth," end quote. Now, this is like Lee's tyrannical at home and aggressive abroad. But he's talking about corruption at home. He's talking about patronage. Is Jefferson right? I don't know whether, as moral character goes, American politicians are as corrupt as, say, those in Bolivia or Albania. But certainly the scale of corruption today is unprecedented. Jefferson was right about that. Consider, according to Harvard economic historian Niall Ferguson, the United States has an unfunded liability, Social Security and all the promises to pay that we have, that tops out at $238 trillion. Now, let's just stop for a moment. I was looking at a trillion seconds. If you took a dollar bill and just laid down one every second, it would take 32,000 years to lay down $1 trillion. We have no idea. I mean, this is like talking about the stars. Unfunded liability, $238 trillion. Larry Kolitikoff, economist that has some status under Bush, I think, anyway, places it at $220 trillion. And, you know, it depends on how you calculate the unfunded liability. It's a dicey thing, and so I'm not going to make any judgment about it. And some have lower figures than that. My point is, these are distinguished economists, and we ought to pay some attention to them, even if they maybe not have gotten it right. It tells us something. Kolitikoff says the U.S. is, quote, arguably in worse financial shape than any other developed country, end quote. To gain some perspective on the scale of this corruption, consider that the GDP of all countries in the world combined last year was $72 trillion, about a third of the central government's unfunded liability, if Ferguson and Kolitikoff's estimates are right. No conceivable arrangement. Now, what are we going to do about this? No conceivable arrangement of national elections today can restrain the momentum of centralization that is built into Lincolnian America, and which was predicted by the Anti-Federalists, by Jefferson, and those later Jeffersonians who wrote the Confederate Constitution. National elections can't do anything. They just enable. They are enablers. The only remedy is some form of state interposition or nullification, whereby the sovereign people of the several states gradually begin recalling those reserve powers they have absent-mindedly, or through their own corruption, allowed to slip out of their hands, because they've been on the take too. It's not just the wicked central government. This constitutional path is once again being explored in the growing 10th Amendment movement, where the states are beginning to interpose their authority to protect their citizens against federal tyranny. You can look at the 10th Amendment Center to see some examples of that. You can Google, get on the web. There's also a growing disposition to consider the Jeffersonian option of dividing the Union to a number of federations. The great diplomat George Kennan in 1993 urged that, and 2012 public policy polling conducted a survey asking those interviewed whether they would like to see their states secede. 18% of Americans favored secession. But the breakdown is interesting. Of the 18 to 29 year olds, 29% favored secession and 21% were not sure. Hispanics, 27% favored secession, 19% not sure. Blacks, 12% favored secession, 16% not sure. But among those identified as very conservative, 37% favored secession, and 15% not sure. 37 favored, 15 not sure. Somewhat conservative, 23% favored, and 18% not sure. Among very liberal, 13% favored secession, and 26% not sure. Somewhat liberal, 13% favored, and 7% not sure. A quarter of Republican voters in 2012 presidential election favored secession of their states. That's one quarter. In short, 80 million Americans are willing to entertain secession of their state. Now, notice we're at the sesquicentennial of the war of 1861-65. Such a poll in the centennial would have been unthinkable. Nobody would ever think to run a poll asking, would you want your state to secede? It'd be like running a poll, do you think it would be best to go back to the British monarchy? It would be that sort of thing. It wouldn't occur to anybody to even ask the question. You see, what's important here is not even the results of the poll, it's that the poll was taken at all. And the results are interesting, too. Lincolnian Americans become nervous. Well, I won't read that. Time's going on. Some fear that if the United States were divided, its parts would not be viable. That is unfounded. Most Americans, and that's probably true of most of us here, have no idea how big this baby is or how big the states are. Let's just look at some figures. Take California. It's larger in population and GDP than Canada. California has 38 million, Canada has 34 million. And yet, Canada's viable, isn't it? Does anybody believe Canada's not viable? Texas, if independent, would have the 14th largest GDP in the world out of 190 countries. Texas and California have a GDP nearly tied with Germany. Well, listen to this. Texas and Florida have a GDP larger than Russia. And the neocons and all are getting us all worked up about Russia. They have nuclear weapons, but Texas and Florida has a GDP greater. Now, GDP doesn't tell us everything, but it tells us something. Texas and California have a GDP larger than Great Britain and slightly under France. Pennsylvania has a GDP larger than Switzerland. Even Vermont, the smallest American state, has a GDP larger than Latvia or Estonia, both of which bravely seceded from the Soviet Empire. And they're viable. For the sake of argument, let's imagine a Jeffersonian America divided into four federations of states: the North, the South, the Midwest, and West. The South would have a GDP of $4.9 trillion and would be the third largest GDP in the world after China and Japan. You are the third largest after the Oriental Tigers in the East. The North, with $4.2 trillion, would be the fourth. The West, with $3.8 trillion, would be the fifth. The Midwest, having $2.2 trillion, will be the 10th largest GDP, but not far behind France, Britain, and Brazil, and greater than Russia, which would be 11th. These four federations would be in the top 10 highest GDP countries in the world. And they could form a NATO pact for defense. And they have two big medieval moats to protect them, one called the Atlantic and the other the Pacific. It's going to be hard to get an invasion force over. America would be viable if only Texas were independent, or any American state could be a viable country. They have the legislature, the executive, the judiciary, they have the practice. They could overnight, it'd be different. You know, there'd be adjustments, but anyway, they could do it. All right, though still dominant, Lincolnian Americanism has exhausted its moral and intellectual resources. Remember that I said that Lincolnian Americanism begins in 1865. By 1960, it's beginning to fracture when students start burning the American flag. And then we get the civil rights movement, we get cultural Marxist Americanism, universalist Americanism, battling Anglo-Protestant Americanism. So Lincolnian Americanism is at war with itself. Jeffersonian Americanism has been suppressed, and it declares a plague on all those houses. But it's now beginning to, it's not awake, it's beginning to awaken, though. That poll shows that. And the difference, the fact that we wouldn't have had those polls on secession in 1960. Jeffersonian Americans are coming out of a drunken stupor. They're opening their eyes and kind of see the room, but nothing's in focus. But now is the time to educate those people. They are looking around the room, trying to find out where the doors and windows are. So they're open. Prior, in 1960, they were still drunk. Maybe not drunk, but they were asleep. I don't know that Jeffersonians get drunk. It was pretty moderate. Maybe the Southern wing gets drunk. But anyway, though still dominant, Lincolnian Americanism has exhausted its moral and intellectual resources in attempting to draw the teeth of state sovereignty as pre-Lincolnians, such as Alexander Hamilton sought to do at the beginning. It has created a regime that can define the limits of its own powers, has created a vast, impenetrable bureaucracy, and has lost the knowledge of how to stop growing. It doesn't know how to do it. It is like an alcoholic or drug addict, this cannot be fixed by Lincolnian national elections. These function only as enablers, which allow the addict to continue his bad habits. What is needed is an old-fashioned family intervention, where the parents, spouse, children, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and priests intervene to bring the addict back to reality. In Jeffersonian America, that function belongs to the states. They are the aunts and uncles and priests that need to show up. Today, some states are recalling their Jeffersonian inheritance and are debating intervention either through nullification or through state-initiated amendments to the Constitution via Article 5. And that would be a very respectable way to begin waking the central government up. Whether they have the civic virtue to follow through is an open question. In this debate, we must keep in mind that we have inherited a fractured historical memory due to the Lincolnian Revolution of 1865, which overthrew the Jeffersonian Revolution of 1800. Although the Jeffersonian vision has been suppressed, it is still vital in the DNA of Americans. And so we must all confront this question. Are you a Jeffersonian American, or are you a Lincolnian American? Thank you.